Hey everyone, I'm Cass Piancy, and I'll be having a discussion with my writing partner and friend, Bennett Tomlin, about the history of and controversies surrounding Bitfinex and Tether. Considering that the New York Attorney General recently settled with Bitfinex and Tether, it seems like a poignant moment to reflect on how we got here and why people like Bennett and myself remain skeptical. While many people, including Bitfinex's and Tether's own general counsel and chief technology officer, seem to believe that the story is over, that simply isn't true. We're going to be using this discussion as an opportunity to not only introduce new investors to an old story, but also dispel false concepts and reinforce reasons to still question the reliability of Bitfinex and Tether. We also put out a couple tweets asking people to send us some questions, and depending on how many times we record, you may have a chance to reach out and ask questions after this is released. Anyway, now that we've established what's going on here, I'd like to have Bennett introduce himself.
Hi everyone, I'm Bennett Tomlin, and along with Cass, I am writing a book about Tether and Bitfinex. For my day job, I work on fraud detection for pharmacy claims, and I enjoy investigating various frauds, scams, and strange companies of all sorts.
So, what we're going to do, I think most of the people listening right now probably have a good idea of what Tether and Bitfinex are, but I think it would behoove us to discuss the founding principles behind both of them, what they originally intended to be, whether or not they accomplished that at this point.
So if we want to start with Bitfinex, Bitfinex was originally not just an exchange. It was a trading platform that was meant to serve as a meta exchange, connecting a whole bunch of other exchanges together so that from this single platform, you'd be able to trade in a whole bunch of places to try to take advantage of differences in prices and stuff like that. So the original Bitfinex platform was based on a stolen Bitcoinica code and was connected to Mt. Gox and Bitstamp to help them bootstrap their liquidity.
And the idea behind Tether, which began a little bit later than Bitfinex, the basic idea surrounding Tether was a cryptocurrency that's backed by US dollars and represents one US dollar. So for every Tether that exists in the world, in a full reserve bank account somewhere, there is a US dollar backing it, and that all Tethers are issued after a dollar is received in this bank account. I think, does that sum it up correctly?
We could argue about how they phrased full reserve at different times. I don't think they necessarily at any point intended to keep the money in whatever a full reserve bank account is. But the goal was to have in a bank account $1 for every single Tether that was issued.
Right. And we can talk about other promises later, but now it might be worthwhile discussing the overall perspective. And are they similar to what they were at the beginning, or have they significantly changed from what they originally intended to be?
Bitfinex no longer draws liquidity from other exchanges or does any of the meta exchange functions that it used to. And so now all the trades on Bitfinex are routed through their own order matching engine and stay on that exchange. And Tether no longer even pretends to have $1 in a bank account for every Tether that's issued. It's no longer part of their promises, part of their terms of service, or anything.
Right. And so I think to most people that maybe sounds like a discrepancy, but it doesn't necessarily sound like the biggest issue in the world. It's good to point out that Tether provides the majority of the liquidity for the cryptocurrency space, and that it feels like a risk because it's such a key player in the overall health of the cryptocurrency marketplace.
I think saying it feels like a risk really understates it. It almost without a doubt is a risk. I mean, Tether is the collateral for a whole bunch of the leverages, the future, the liquidity, the volume. It represents a major risk to the market on any given day.
Right. Okay, so who were the key players at the beginning for both Bitfinex and, after that, Tether?
Sure. So Bitfinex was founded by Raphael Nicolet, a Frenchman who was working as a help desk technician up until this point. He was a major participant in and defender of the infamous Trendon Shaver's Ponzi scheme, which resulted in him losing a whole bunch of his bitcoins.
Just wanted to jump in here after the fact. We already recorded, but I thought it would be important to emphasize that probably a lot of people don't have any clue who Trendon Shaver's is. Bennett is talking about a guy named Trendon Shaver's from Texas who created a Ponzi scheme. His online name was Pirate at 40. If you look up Trendon Shaver's, T-R-E-N-D-O-N Shaver's, S-H-A-V-E-R-S, you'll find one of the first things that's going to come up is a Southern District of New York press release that says, Texas man sentenced for operating Bitcoin Ponzi scheme. Just wanted to clarify that. Hopefully that explains it. And now we'll just continue on with Bennett.
Shortly after he loses all these Bitcoins, he first tries to start an OTC desk. And then after that fails, he tries to start his own high yield lending program where people would loan him Bitcoins with a guaranteed return of 2% per year. He ended up moving on from that scheme and decided to start Bitfinex. To do this, he used the recently leaked source code of a failed Bitcoin exchange called Bitcoinica. Bitcoinica was an exchange that was popular because it offered leverage, allowing traders to magnify their gains. But it had a variety of bugs and security issues. The code itself was written by a 17-year-old in Ruby on Rails, and Raphael basically took that code base, many of the bugs and security issues intact, and started Bitfinex with it.
Okay, and I think the best way to sum that up might be that someone who was well known in the Ponzi circles, so back early, 2010s, 2015 period, high yield investment products had entire message boards devoted to them, where people knew exactly what they were buying into, with the hope being that they would be one of the few that were able to get out and leaving some with bags. There's other people who have been caught criminally involved in Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies who match the same profile. The one that sticks out in my mind is Gerald Cotton and Michael Pattern, who both were in on this kind of high yield investment product and then got into Bitcoin because of that. So I think there is some connection there in the early history, but we have to move past the idea that it was founded by someone who maybe didn't have the best intentions, because at the end of the day, Raphael was able to sell Bitfinex, and he sold it to the people in charge currently, right? And that's Giancarlo Devasini and Vanderveld, correct?
Yes. The next person to come on is Giancarlo Devasini, who was a former doctor and retired software pirate from Italy, who somehow came across Bitfinex and ended up joining the exchange. It seems that he was able to then connect them with some investors in Asia that allowed them to bring some more funding in, modernize the exchange, update a lot of that kind of stuff. And during that period, we see JLVDV come on, Vanderveld, as you mentioned, who is now the CEO of both Bitfinex and Tether.
That brings us to the current executive leadership that we have today. Obviously, we can include Phil Potter at some point getting involved with the two of them to represent the U.S. arm, essentially, of Bitfinex. I mean, we can call it something different than that. He was the chief strategy officer, so I think that there's a lot to be said with the fact that he was located in New York City proper. Regardless, two out of three of these individuals still in charge over there at Bitfinex and Tether. But Tether has a different birth story. So let's talk about that. How did Tether come to be?
In the first half of 2014, a token called Realcoin was announced that was being led by Brock Pierce, Craig Sellers, William Quigley, and Reeve Collins. And this coin eventually became Tether and was meant to serve the same purpose, a dollar-backed token on the blockchain. It was using what is now the Omni layer, which is a second layer on top of Bitcoin, which allowed this kind of thing to start to exist. William Quigley, who is now the CEO of Worldwide Asset Exchange, has said in interviews that they had had the idea for RealCoin for years and had been working on getting it started, but were never able to find banking for it. Also confusing this is no tokens were ever issued as RealCoin. Phil Potter and Juan Carlo De Vicini in September of 2014 formed Tether Holdings Limited out of the British Virgin Islands, and the very first tethers were issued in shortly after that, in November of 2014. And so there's often this narrative that RealCoin existed, Tether existed, led by these people, and was then bought out by Bitfinex and Tether. But that narrative is a bit of a fiction, because Tether and the Tether token has only ever existed under the control of Bitfinex.
Yeah, that was a point I was about to touch on. We're discussing Bitfinex and Tether almost as though they're separate entities. Now, I guess they are, but we need to call attention to the fact that these both live under the same parent company. There's an umbrella there, and they both live under it. As you just stated, they're related from the very get-go, because before Tether ever issued U.S. dollar-based coins, they sold to the people at Bitfinex. And it's important to note that, because it means that the individuals who started it couldn't figure out a way to make it work. And somehow, some way, the gentleman at Bitfinex did figure out a way.
Yes. And I think also interesting at this point is, like, Craig Sellers, if I remember right, stays on the Tether team for a while, acting as their CTO and helping them with some of the implementation stuff. But as far as I know, like, Quigley, Brock, and Reeve were all left the team pretty shortly after the first Tether started being issued. And so they did not stay on in any real meaningful capacity.
This is already feeling a little convoluted, and there's a reason for that. I think it's difficult to discuss corporate fraud without it getting bogged down in a multitude of different corporations and trying to connect them and trying to identify who's in charge of what and where and who owns what and why. As soon as you try to explain it, it almost feels like you're talking about something, a web of deceit that couldn't possibly be true, right?
Oh, yeah. I often feel like a crazy person when I'm discussing these things, because you end up drawing these strange connections between shell companies in different jurisdictions and stuff like that. But then, as the picture's been gradually revealed over the years, it turns out that the connections you've been drawing and looking at were not spurious and were the way they were trying to hide and manipulate things.
Right. And the reason that we can emphasize that fact, I think one of the striking things about this whole situation is that Bitfinex denied any relation or ownership of Tether for years. Though people would ask about it, people thought that it could be the case. Bitfinex denied this thoroughly until it was exposed in the Panama Papers and it was proven to be true. So once there was evidence in the public realm, they finally admitted publicly that they were connected. Now, what does that mean?
Yeah, the story is a little bit more complicated than that, actually, around Bitfinex denying / accepting Tether as their property. If you go back in the Internet Archive, you can look at the early team pages for Tether, and you'll see the same team members as Bitfinex listed. And that was like a point they emphasized in some of their early marketing materials. However, at that same time, you have Juan Carlo, who's the CFO of both companies, pretending on Bitcoin Talk that he's waiting for an invitation from Tether so he can start using it. Intermittently at times, you've got both Phil Potter and Zane Tackett denying the connection between Bitfinex and Tether. And Phil Potter even continued to deny this fact after Bitfinex and Tether filed a lawsuit together to try to sue Wells Fargo in 2017. Shortly after that, they ended up recanting and saying, yeah, we're the majority shareholders of Tether, and we got the documentation from the Paradise Papers to prove it.
And while this just sounds like some strange web, this is just the surface. Coming full circle to where we sit today and why we're talking about this again is that they've come to a settlement with the New York AG. So we're skipping ahead a bit, but they've come to a settlement with the New York AG. The reason they had to come to this settlement is because the New York AG saw problems with Bitfinex and Tether, the relationship between the two, and the way that they were commingling client and corporate funds.
And they weren't just commingling client and corporate funds in each corporation. They were commingling funds of the two corporations, which is, again, gets kind of into the fact that they pretend these are two separate entities. But to really understand them, you almost need to treat them as one entity because that is how they behave. And I think kind of a thing we keep bumping up against here is a lot of the stuff we're describing sounds really strange. And lots of times when you're looking into frauds or scams or things like this, you come up with that a lot. And that's intentional. The goal of many of these things is to muddy the waters and to make it harder to track the story. But as you follow the Bitfinex and Tether story, there's several points you hit where the only explanations you can come up with for what they're doing are either just blatant incompetence or just absolute fraud.
Who knows when this will come out, but today JP Koenig was saying that they're essentially bigger than PayPal in terms of total liabilities, which is it's still a very niche topic and a niche thing, but it is bigger than PayPal, which is otherworldly for someone like myself to imagine that.
It quite literally boggles my mind. I cannot wrap my head around that fact.
Let's look at how we got to this settlement date. What started it all? What were the first red flags, not just in the relationship between Tether and Bitfinex, but also with Bitfinex, the exchange itself, with Tether perhaps itself separately? But let's start at the beginning. What were the first red flags outside of the initial ownership?
The initial red flags are people responding to Raphael's announcement of Bitfinex going, hey, you forgot to patch these Bitcoinica bugs. We can do all this stuff to exploit your brand new exchange. The second red flags would come with early in Bitfinex's history, there were a couple of cases where they had major liquidation events and their trading engine couldn't really handle it. And so you've got lots of traders who claim they weren't liquidated at the right price. Moving forward, you get into what I think of as like the series of hacks, where you've got Bitfinex has their hot wallet completely drained in May of 2015. Then in 2016, Bitfinex suffers one of the largest hacks of all time, losing at the time like 75 million in Bitcoin. That's now worth multiple billions of dollars.
So let's pause right there. Why does this happen? Do we know what happened with the Bitfinex hack, this incredible hack that now, like you said, I don't know how many billions of dollars it's worth, but upwards of five now. I don't even know how many billions we're talking. We're talking a lot of money. What happened?
Well, it's not entirely clear. Bitfinex had recently settled with the Commodities and Futures Trading Commission because they had been offering illegal derivatives to U.S. residents. In order to solve this problem, they started moving to a BitGo multi-signature segregated wallet infrastructure, which is complicated, but basically what it means is each user at Bitfinex would have their own address on the blockchain. They could check to see that their expected number of Bitcoins were there. And when Bitfinex would go to deliver these futures contracts, specifically, especially for the US residents, they would be able to physically deliver them to that user's wallet. In order to withdraw from these wallets, it was supposed to be a 2 of 3 signing thing, where you needed either Bitfinex's key, BitGo's key, or the user's key. The exact mechanism of the hack has never been made clear, because Bitfinex has never made it clear, but there's a couple of people who've had different theories about how this might have happened. First, in order for Bitfinex to have BitGo sign a transaction saying we should withdraw this amount, Bitfinex has an API key where they can submit a request to BitGo, basically with a signature saying we've signed, we approve this, sign for this transaction, and then it can be withdrawn. In order to limit the power of that, the ability for like a single transaction to drain an entire wallet, BitGo also has withdrawal limits. And so generally, that would be under a different key than the key you use to signal you want to withdraw something. The, in my mind, most likely way this hack occurred is Bitfinex had not been separating those two keys. They were using the same BitGo API key to sign for withdrawals as they used to manage the service, so to deal with things like withdrawal limits. So the person who absconded with the funds was able to get access to the Bitfinex key and then the Bitfinex BitGo API key. And so they were able to first sign a message to BitGo saying remove the withdrawal limit. And then they were able to go through and say, we want to withdraw this one to here, this one to here, this one to here, and sign all these transactions to withdraw all these Bitcoins from the shared infrastructure. Some of the things that support this theory is that they were able to withdraw more than the withdrawal limit. So the withdrawal limit had to have been changed. And so either they were able to compromise three keys, the one to change the withdrawal limit and the one to sign transactions, both for BitGo and Bitfinex, or Bitfinex was not appropriately segregating those keys. This would also be supported by the fact that after the incident, BitGo said other people do not need to change the way they're set up. Bitfinex had a unique setup that allowed this to occur. We've never learned the exact details of what that unique setup looks like, but my guess is Bitfinex had given that API key, the one to sign transactions, too many permissions in BitGo. And so when that was compromised, they were able to abscond with such a large portion of the funds.
There's no speculation in regard to who that hack could have been by. And law enforcement isn't going after this person. And Bitfinex, while they have offered rewards, also isn't essentially going after this person. And so no one really knows. Is that...
That's close to the truth. The hacker has never been arrested, so law enforcement hasn't figured out who it is. There's people, of course, with theories about who might have been involved, but never anything that has been verified. So Bitfinex has, at a couple of different points and through a couple of different people and mediums, tried to reach out to the hacker. It's plausible to me that Bitfinex might have insight into who the hacker might be. Otherwise, maybe they're just throwing them into the ether for the hopes that that person will resurface. It's again somewhat unclear because we never got the promised security audit from Bitfinex after the hack.
Bitfinex did promise a security audit for this. They've made a lot of promises regarding audits, but this was a very important one because they promised a security audit, but they also promised a financial audit of some kind for Bitfinex itself. We're outside the scope of Tether right now.
Yes, you are absolutely correct. And so originally Bitfinex retained Ledger Labs to do their security report, and Bitfinex for some reason believed that they could do a financial audit. When Ledger Labs informed them, no, we're a security company, we can't do a financial audit, Bitfinex told the public they would find a new financial auditor, and they eventually did in Friedman, who is the same firm that was supposed to audit Tether. Bitfinex claimed to have been in possession of a security report, not a security audit, they said security report, from Ledger Labs. That has never been released in any format to the public, and Ledger Labs, like on their website, does not list Bitfinex among their former clients. Friedman was supposed to audit both Bitfinex and Tether. Eventually, a Tether spokesperson came out and basically said, Friedman is being too detailed, we can't get audited, the relationship is dissolved. Bitfinex has never come out and said what's going on with their audit, but I think considering it's been 3.5 years, it's safe to assume it's probably no longer ongoing.
Okay, just to recap where we are here, number one, Bitfinex is founded by a Ponzi scheming, in financial terms, ethically gray individual who goes on to sell to a former criminal who's fascinated by Bitcoin. And when it comes to Tether, we have the creation of the idea by a group of essentially intellectual tech guys who...
And Brock.
Who then go on to sell the idea and little more than that to the executives at Bitfinex, who later go on to run with the idea. But we haven't even hit that point yet, because at the point that this Bitfinex hack happens, where they lose roughly 36% of everyone's account, the industry around Bitfinex, not the industry itself, but the industry around Bitfinex is in trouble. With this 36% loss, not only do you have a lack of confidence from your customers and possible investors, but you have a lot of other issues that are now being presented, because how many people are going to want to be onboarded by a company like that? And a slew of issues basically to cope with. Now you have to deal, you have to whole new security risks that you have to account for because your system is clearly broken. What did Bitfinex do to not go belly up after they lost all of this money?
They figured out a way to make their harshest critics some of their biggest supporters. What they actually did mechanically was issued a statement basically saying we're going to be taking a 36% haircut from everyone's account, and in exchange for every dollar we take, you will get a single BFX token, and we promise to pay it back, but not in any legally binding way. Later, we find out that not every single account got that haircut. Nathaniel Popper of the New York Times has mentioned that when he was doing his reporting on the hack, turns out that Coinbase, who had stored some bitcoins on Bitfinex, did not receive the same haircut as everyone else. It's unknown whether anyone else got special treatment, but at the very least, we've got reason to believe Coinbase did. Back to what we're looking at. Everyone has just had their account reduced by 36%. They're upset. They're angry. People are threatening to sue Bitfinex. Bitfinex gives them this BFX token. It's going to take a long time for Bitfinex to pay back these tokens. And so what they start doing is telling traders, if you convert this token to Bitfinex equity instead, you'll be able to get it switched out faster. And if you exchange it, we've got investors over in Asia who'd be willing to buy your shares off of you. So you'd be able to get to liquidity sooner. Then they created a second token because, again, they want to make sure this is as complicated as possible. This token was called the Recovery Rights Token, and what it was meant to do was incentivize more people to convert to equity rather than waiting for Bitfinex to pay back the cash they'd taken. What the token offered was a portion of any recovered Bitcoins from the hack. So if Bitfinex had been able to, through law enforcement negotiation or an act of God, regain the tokens that they had lost in that hack, then they would be distributed to the various RRT token holders. And the only way to get an RRT token was to convert your BFX tokens to equity. What ends up happening? You've got a bunch of traders who are upset that they just lost 36% of their account, basically, in an exchange got a token with no intrinsic value. But then Bitfinex offers them an ability to become a partial owner of Bitfinex. From that point on, instead of being incentivized to criticize Bitfinex to draw attention to these shortcomings and these failings, they are now incentivized to make sure Bitfinex succeeds, and not just succeeds, but is as successful as possible. And so in this really clever and debatably legal way, Bitfinex was able to take all of their upset traders after this hack and convert many of them to huge supporters of Bitfinex to this day.
And I think that we need to acknowledge kind of the genius level of partnering with your enemy to silence them that took place here, because you don't see it that often. And I actually think that it's a pretty intelligent move. I reflect on other companies in traditional finance. Equifax comes to mind, where you have this massive hack and people are upset and they think, I don't want to use this thing. I don't trust these guys anymore. And I wonder how quickly those feelings and those emotions would have been resolved if someone like Equifax could have done a similar type of thing where they say, here's some cash and a little equity and we'll call it even, guys, because I think it's not the worst way to try to Band-Aid over a big issue.
I think it was relatively clever. And there were even attempts to kind of make it more legitimate. There was some recent reporting by Nicola Borzi, who's an investigative journalist out of Italy, that suggests that Juan Carlo approached a couple of places in Switzerland about trying to find a way to actually like tokenize the official debt and make the BFX token with no legal liability more of like a real financial instrument. These ended up not panning out. But in the interim, Bitfinex found a way to seemingly satisfy most of the traders who were harmed in the hack.
We end up in a place where a company that in many ways, the people who utilize it rely on the operational security of the technologists there. They rely on the ability of these people to preempt any kind of major issues that they're going to see, be it liquidity or downtime to servers or hacks or any of these things. And they were able to change people's minds. At the same time, Tether, which they've already owned now for a little while, begins to pick up a little bit of pace right after this hack. Within about 6 to 8 months after this hack, we start to see Tether gradually growing from a $5 million nothing to $100 million, something like that. The growth is exponential and it's very quick.
Yeah, that is true. And there's some other oddities surrounding this same period too. So we're talking about the BFX token, but it's not really a token like Tether's a token. When you're talking about Tether, you can look on the blockchain and you can find the tethers. With the BFX token, though this was briefly planned, it never panned out. It was just an entry in the Bitfinex database. However, during the period where they're paying back these BFX tokens, Phil Potter is in Whalepool TeamSpeaks telling traders and stuff that they're trying to find a way to swap BFX tokens for Tether tokens and stuff like that. Compounding the strangeness, the announcement that they have paid off every single outstanding BFX token comes mere days before they announce that they've been cut off from their U.S. correspondent banking with Wells Fargo. The exact timeline of events gets a little murky here, but it seems reasonably likely to me that there were BFX token holders who converted to Bitfinex equity unaware that they were having banking issues. Well, the executives who facilitated this transformation were aware that there were banking issues.
I'm going to try to express this in ways that one of my big issues with crypto in general is that people have to be fluent in so many different things. What you're talking about is being fluent in tech, being fluent in finance, being fluent in trading strategies, being fluent in a million different things. And at the end of the day, most people just aren't that, including myself. So what you're more or less identifying is that executives seem to have a beneficial view of what was transpiring as opposed to everyone else.
I'm more curious as to whether or not Bitfinex was misrepresenting itself, in effect, to its shareholders and potential investors. Potential investors being, in this case, people who wanted to convert their BFX token to Bitfinex equity. I think the Bitfinex executives were aware that problems were coming, that they were going to be having these difficulties. Yet, they did not make these people who were going to be converting aware of those because they wanted to get those liabilities off their books before they had to announce that they'd been cut off from banking.
So I want to rally on the point right now that we're just discussing the very beginnings of this, and that is, it's not irrelevant in any way. It absolutely pertains to where we stand with Tether and the role that Tether plays systemically to the broader industry. But the story isn't Bitfinex anymore. That story is gone. No one cares about Bitfinex. The volume at Bitfinex is dead. No one uses Bitfinex. It's almost like it's a remnant of the past quickly, right? Like this is something that was a market leader not 3-4 years ago, and now no one utilizes it like they used to. Meanwhile, Tether has become a spectacle. And I don't quite understand what happened and why, even though they have the same ownership, even though everything about them in many ways is that they're run by the same people who are operating in similar ways, why is one of them being systemically used still and definitely the main story that's been going forward and main story discussed, while the other isn't? And I think that it's important to note that one of these things, they're both very similar, and one of them is gone, and the other is one of the most important things going on today in the cryptocurrency ecosystem.
Well, and I think there's one reason we can kind of point to for that, and it's the rise of Binance. There was a new exchange on the block that offered similar features that were valuable to traders, was willing to list a larger number of tokens, was willing to provide leverage on a variety of different assets, and was willing eventually to collateralize their futures with Tether. So as Binance blew up, Tether blew up, and Binance, meanwhile, was pulling traders away from Bitfinex.
I guess I'm wondering why it amounted to Binance being that catalyst for Tether, because before Binance, there were others, right? I mean, I believe Huobi is older than Binance, and I know for a fact that OKCoin was before Binance, and neither of those platforms were able to develop the same kind of catalyst that Binance did. And I agree with you, and though the systemic problems with Tether now amount to far more than just Binance and Bitfinex and Tether, I do think you're right that Binance kind of started this, but I'm wondering why. Why Binance? Why is this important? Why is everyone paying attention to it? And why is Bitfinex not important at all?
Well, I mean, 2018 is probably the answer, right? Is that you see Bitfinex start to have some really serious issues servicing withdrawals, dealing with things like that, rumors spreading online that they're insolvent, and that the traders are experiencing evidence of that when they try to withdraw and aren't able to, right? I think you started to see a shift in people's, in traders' perspective of Bitfinex, simultaneous with a new exchange rising that offered them many of the features they used to rely on Bitfinex for. And so I think it was just largely a chance that those events happened to coincide and that Binance was able to take advantage of it. Technologically, my intuition is that Binance had less technical debt, was probably running a little bit cleaner, a little bit smoother than some of the older exchanges. And so because of that, seemed faster and better to traders. But I'm not a trader. That's not my area of expertise, so I can't be sure of that. It's just kind of my intuition about what forces would have led to this.
But at the end of the day, that's continued, and Binance has retained that marketplace leadership, while Bitfinex has, I don't know what level of import Bitfinex plays in the broader marketplace, other than they are the owner of Tether. I think that most people don't give a shit about Bitfinex. It's kind of astounding to me, because while Coinbase, for instance, has the amount of people utilizing them has grown for sure since 2017, and while I may not like them or their business model, they seem to be doing well. Kraken seems to still be doing well. A lot of these exchanges seem to be doing great, and Bitfinex, after it suffered these problems, seems to have never fully recovered, despite the fact that I do think equity shareholders probably made money, and I do think that a lot of people who were involved in Bitfinex made a ton of money. So I'm not trying to suggest that the people involved were failures, but the exchange itself is no longer important. Meanwhile, again, Tether, it's astounding the role that Tether continues to play to this day, but it's the same ownership and many of the same problems. So it's very odd. It's not hypocritical as much as I just don't quite understand why. If it's a moat, I just don't really understand.
I think, Tether has kind of a built-in network effect, right? The more exchanges that integrate Tether, the more places that use Tether, the more valuable Tether becomes to traders. The more traders are going to want it. Whereas Bitfinex doesn't have that same kind of network effect, so they need to compete more directly. And I think what we saw, especially post-2017, was kind of a bifurcation of exchanges in the market. And so you've got ones like Coinbase, Gemini, Kraken, ones who are compliant basically to the letter of the law. They're trying to make their operations as legitimate as possible, especially in the case of Coinbase, because they're hoping to IPO eventually. And then you've got exchanges like Binance that try to exist nowhere and everywhere and avoid as much regulation as possible. For a long time, Bitfinex had kind of tried to straddle the line. They'd been willing to negotiate with the CFTC. They'd been willing to make attempts at KYC and stuff to try to convince banks to bank them. And so because of this, they couldn't or weren't as aggressive in their token listings or in pushing new features. And then where they interacted with the regulated space. So with banks and stuff, you see them get cut off from the banking. You see them start to get under investigation by multiple US federal agencies. And so because they tried to exist near the regulated space, they took a lot of that regulatory heat, but they didn't have, they weren't able to be quite as free as the exchanges that tried to avoid all of that.
Right. Okay. Fair enough. I think that'll wrap it up for our first discussion. We got to the first hack. We discussed that a little bit, and we're starting to delve into the idea that Tether is ramping up and getting popular. But I think the majority of the story is going to be in the next one, where we're going to discuss that massive growth in 2018, 2017, 2018, and collapse, these investigations, what the settlement means to skeptics, and what we think it means to people who are proponents. But for now, I think this is a good introduction for the early history of Bitfinex and all of the problems that after 3 years or more have yet to be addressed. Hey everyone, thanks for listening. I just wanted to quickly add that we're going to be doing another one of these discussions within the next week or so. That's when we're going to be addressing any questions that were sent our way on Twitter. So if you have any questions, issues, concerns, something you don't understand that you would like addressed, feel free to send it to us. And we're going to try to take the time to answer all of those questions next time. Hopefully we have the time to answer yours. If not, we'll try to get to it on Twitter. So thanks again for listening. Appreciate it. Take care.